Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
With Justin Brierley.
Welcome along to Unbelievable, the show from Premier Christian Radio here in the UK, broadcasting around the world as a podcast and bringing you conversations that matter between Christians and skeptics every week. I'm Justin Brierley, thrilled to be bringing you today the third episode of our Big Conversation series. It all launched 4 weeks ago with a very popular debate between psychologist Jordan B. Peterson and atheist Susan Blackmore, and the second episode with Harvard atheist Steven Pinker and Christian thinker Nick Spencer has also been getting a lot of engagement since we released it. Well, today's Big Conversation is between two Brits, illusionist and mentalist Derren Brown, a star of stage and screen who was once a Christian. He'll be in dialogue with former pop star turned Christian priest and broadcaster Reverend Richard Coles. I'll be introducing them and the subject very shortly. But if you're new to all this, The Big Conversation is a video series from Unbelievable in which I'm sitting down with some of the biggest thinkers in the Christian and atheist world to talk about science, faith, philosophy, and what it means to be human. So the first three episodes are available now to watch as videos at The Big Conversation website. Can I encourage you to go and watch and share the video of today's discussion? And while you're there, sign up for the Unbelievable newsletter to be notified about new episodes, bonus content, and extra resources. That's all at thebigconversation.show. Now, the website also includes links for our recently released Unbelievable app, featuring the podcast, articles, bonus content, all in one place on your mobile device. So do check that out or look it up in your app store. And also, final places going very fast now for our live audience edition of The Big Conversation on Wednesday, the 18th of July in London. I'm going to be joined by Professor John Lennox and Professor Michael Roos, a Christian and an atheist, to discuss science, faith, and the evidence for God. So if you want to be there yourself, do check out the live event at thebigconversation.show, and of course links to the app, show videos, and sign up for our newsletter and exclusive video clips. Thebigconversation.show is what you need. Later on, I'll tell you how to get in touch with the show, and towards the end of the program, I'll be revealing more details about Unbelievable coming to the west coast of the USA at the end of this summer. But for now, without further ado, sit back and listen to the third episode of The Big Conversation. Welcome to The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The Big Conversation is a series of shows exploring faith, science, philosophy, and what it means to be human in association with the Templeton Religion Trust. Today, our conversation topic is the pursuit of happiness. Can we have meaning without God? The Big Conversation partners I'm sitting down with today are Derren Brown and the Reverend Richard Coles. Derren Brown is an illusionist and mentalist famous for his TV and stage shows. He's also an author of books such as Tricks of the Mind, which both reveal his love of stagecraft and psychology, but also tell the story of how he lost his faith in Christianity as a young adult. His latest book, Happy, Why More or Less Everything is Absolutely Fine, brings the wisdom of Greek Stoic philosophy to bear on how to lead a content, fulfilled and meaningful life. Well, the Reverend Richard Coles is a priest in the Church of England and a well-known media figure on radio and TV, presenting Radio 4 Saturday Live and a star turns in programmes such as Strictly Come Dancing. He's also had a highly successful and often wild pop career in the past as part of the Communards. And he's also told his story of his Christian conversion in books such as Fathomless Riches and Bringing in the Sheaves, both of which feature him on the cover with his beloved Dashuns. So welcome along to the programme, Darren and Richard. Great to have you here.
Hello.
Hello.
It's nice to have you. I know you two gentlemen do know each other a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's not the first time you've spoken together.
And this is true. I was a guest on your radio show.
And I was a guest at breakfast at yours.
And you became over some really terrible scrambled eggs.
Why did you say they were lovely scrambled eggs?
No, they were really hard. I did them in a bain-marie, which I was very excited about.
Right.
They just kept cooking.
You completely dazzled me with your bain-marie work. I thought that was the most sophisticated scrambled eggs I'd ever had.
Gosh. I shouldn't have said a thing.
There you go. You've spoiled it. Yeah. Well, in any case, sorry there's no breakfast items on this occasion, but it's good to have you both here for this conversation, which I'm not sure either of you have really had in this kind of environment, talking about faith and your different worldviews and the search for meaning. And in a way, it was really great that you were both available, because you've got stories that in some ways are the mirror of each other. Perhaps we could start with you, Darren, and just remind us of the fact that you were actually at one time a Christian.
Yes.
When you were a young man. A younger man, I should say.
A young girl, I thought you were about to say that. Yeah, a younger man. Yeah. Yes.
What kind of drew you towards Christianity to begin with?
I was six, I think, and I had a teacher at school that I really liked called Mrs. Whittaker, and she asked me if I wanted to come to her Crusaders classes. And I didn't have any religious friends. My family weren't at all religious. But I was six and I liked the teacher, and so I just presumed everybody does that. Everybody goes to Crusader classes. So I went. And by the time I was old enough to realize, oh no, this is a sort of a belief now that I have, this is a thing that's not everybody has, it was a bit too sort of late. It was, I say late, but it was, you know, I believed it and that was that. And it was certainly too late to rethink it from any kind of other viewpoint. So I just sort of found myself in it. And then I went to various churches, still didn't really have any Christian friends particularly. And then at university, so sometime later, I got into hypnosis and close-up magic and the sort of career that I'm now in. And it started to drive a bit of a wedge between me and the Christians that I knew. I was surprised at their reactions. I could sort of understand it, but I thought, well, I'm fascinated by the mind, and presumably the mind is the pinnacle of God's creation, if that's the story that you have. So I couldn't quite understand the sort of immediate
suspicion,
sort of fear and hostility.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. At the same time, I had the other thing that magic tends to sort of teach you is a skepticism towards things like psychic abilities and tarot cards and all that. And I was going to churches where there was a huge amount, again, of a sort of fear of that sort of new age thing that was creeping in. Lots of talks of demons and so on. But because I could see how they worked, just as a sort of psychological trick, again, just a little sort of question mark went up. And I had a good friend who was a psychic healer, and we had endless talks about how that was just a bit of a circular belief system that she was caught in. And gradually I just started to think, well, I'm sure I'm just doing the same. But I'm doing the same with something that's far more institutionalized and harder to sort of poke fun
at. More culturally acceptable, in
exactly,
a sense.
Exactly,
yes.
Something like, you know, psychic ability. So I went through a period at university of really trying to question it and trying to unpick it. I hope that if I what I did know for sure was that me sitting in a pub and telling my friends why God must exist and why Christianity must be true with all the certainty of a 20-year-old student, I knew that must be nonsense, because it's a question that has puzzled people for so long.
Yeah.
So I thought, I need to undo some of that certainty.
Yep.
And maybe if I'm less certain, there'll be an honesty in that. And maybe from that, I'll build a more rigorous faith. But that second bit didn't happen. It just sort of fell apart.
As I understand it, you did sort of try and see if there were some sort of objective evidences. You did look into sort of the case for the resurrection and things like that.
Yes,
but it never quite came together.
No. So at the time, my sort of feeling was, well, I sort of had this thing in my head, which I think is not uncommon, that if the resurrection didn't happen, it all falls apart. And if it did, it's all real. Mm. You know, I think perhaps there are richer ways of approaching it than that. But at the time, that was a sort of a binary thing. So when I realized that it couldn't, despite being told again and again as a Christian that there's, you know, ample evidence for it, and realizing in the end, well, that sort of isn't, that's not really what it's about. In order to be honest with myself, I just had to let it go.
You let it go. Did you adopt another label like atheist or anything like that? Is that a badge you're happy to wear, in a sense?
Strange thing. Do you collect stamps? Do you collect stamps? No. So you are an aphilatelist.
Right. Non-stamp collector,
yeah,
some
exactly,
people
exactly.
say. Right.
Which is fine, I suppose, in a sense it's an accurate label. But if I would suggest that was in itself had some sort of agenda to it on your part, or meant anything, you might grow a bit tired of it. Or you might want to put your hand up and say, it just doesn't mean anything. You're just defining something in terms of what it isn't. So I suppose I am, in the sense that I don't believe in God, but I don't for a second... maybe at first, I think if you come from a position of strong belief, your natural swing is going to be to a sort of a strong disbelief and a bit of a kind of, you know, you're sort of gathering yourself psychologically. So for a while, I think I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the kind of the attack on what I'd held to be true for a short while. Now I think that's sort of irrelevant and kind of misses the point. So no, I don't happen to believe, but that's sort of it. That doesn't carry with it any agenda beyond that.
Okay, and it's interesting, though, that it was something that obviously was important to you, but once you let it go, you found that it didn't particularly impact your life in terms of, you know, some existential crisis or something.
No, there was no crisis. I, apart from the bubbles in my throat that would occasionally appear.
See?
Never happened. I know, yes, explain that.
Exactly.
It will happen. I had one moment waking up feeling down and... had that moment of going, oh, I don't have that sort of objective yardstick anymore of somebody going, a little voice going, doesn't matter if you feel down, you are loved objectively and irrespective of how you feel. I had a moment of going, oh, so it's sort of up to me now to make my sort of psychological robustness is going to be up to me. And I remember that moment and I sort of thought, oh, that's actually quite a good thing. That's quite liberating. And that was it. That was the only moment I remember of a sort of hiccup. And it was a sort of a good one.
I mean, obviously, you're now well known for your TV and stage shows, and people enjoy the entertainment and everything else. But you often do weave in a sort of a critique of superstition or religion generally.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, do you sort of feel that you have a duty to kind of critique those sorts of ways of thinking from the standpoint you now have?
I don't know if I have a duty, but I. Magic of any sort, and what I do is sort of rooted in magic, is a very childish pursuit. It's the quickest route to impressing people. It's a fraudulent route to impressing people. So you do it if you don't feel very confident or impressive as a kid, and that's most people's roots into it. If that remains your agenda, then like most magicians, I think you become a figure of fun after a while. And it misses the interesting and really rich stuff about magic, which isn't really how you're doing the tricks. It's the fact that we tell ourselves stories and that we get caught up in a story that we are being told, and all those things that an audience member does. Magic doesn't exist unless it happens in the mind of the spectator watching it. Unlike a play that can go over your head, doesn't mean the play's failed, but if you don't follow a trick, you know, it's certainly failed. So I what I've tried to do is hold on to what's interesting, I find interesting about magic, and bring that to an audience. So because of that, those areas of belief and belief systems and charlatans and confidence tricksters and all that, it very naturally falls into a kind of a world of going, let's look at these.
Sure.
I don't think that debunking... for its own sake, is that interesting? Because it's a negative thing, and ultimately it just sort of it strikes the wrong note. So what I've tended to do is recreate things. Like in the last show, I recreated
miracle healing show.
That's right, which you kindly came to see. So I find that by doing something, and if you do it yourself, you can recreate the entertainment value, which is important. Otherwise, if you're just going, no, this is things nonsense, then you're not hitting that note of sort of emotion that the charlatans do have. So you're it's a losing battle.
Yeah.
So that's the closest. I do a lot of that sort of thing, and I suppose the feeling is to, if you present people with the information, at least they can see, oh, this can be done without recourse to that explanation. Then that feels like a valuable thing.
Thank you very much for joining me to talk about your story and this question of the can we have meaning without God. And to join us in this conversation today is the Reverend Richard Coles.
Hello.
Richard, thank you for coming. Your story, in some ways, as I say, is quite different to Darren's, in as much as you went through a period of great fame and success as a pop idol in your generation.
I stood next to someone else who was doing it really for 15 minutes, but I take your point.
But in the Communards, you know, you did have this extraordinary journey, or quite a wild journey, as you relate in the books that you've written as well. Tell us sort of, first of all, what that life was like, what was going on for you at that time, and how you eventually actually came to faith.
Well, I don't really remember that much about it, which I suppose tells you something about the quality of the experience. And I thought, I had this feeling that I'd bought a speedboat in Ibiza, and apparently I did. I checked this with somebody recently, and I did buy a speedboat in Ibiza, which is rusting in some neglected lagoon at the moment, or maybe being used in drug running or something. So it was all the things of, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll and all that kind of thing, or sex and drugs and 80s synth pop, and gender politics and all that, at a particularly kind of exciting and dynamic time. Identity politics. That was all sort of churning up. And I had this sort of period of great success, which coincided with the best of times with the worst of times because of who I was and when I was and where I was. HIV and AIDS came along at the very sort of height of our success, and we were completely out as a gay band. And so the catastrophe of AIDS hit my circle of friends, and that created more turbulence. And it was kind of in that turbulence that I started getting... I was a chorister when I was a kid. So I grew up in the Anglican choral tradition, loved the music, adored the dressing up, scratched and clawed my way to be head chorister and loved that too, but was certain that it was a fairy tale and that nobody with their wits about them could seriously believe the stuff. Although I think I was impressed by people who did seem to seriously believe that stuff and did so with some integrity and honesty, and that sort of took up residence somewhere within. But I do remember when I was young, in spite of that, feeling that churches, chapels, holy places, sacred places were distinctive, and you could take stuff there that somehow belonged there and belonged nowhere else, or not in the same way. And then after that period of turbulence in my late 20s, that's what I sort of, I wanted to return to that too. I think it was partly also, and this is very common, I think, for gay men of my age, a sort of desire to connect with a childhood that had felt rather abandoned and left behind because you needed to, you know, if discovering you were gay in Kettering in 1977 was not something that suggested a life rich in opportunity lay ahead. So I wanted to reconnect to my past.
Right.
And this all sort of came together. And then it was a sort of curiosity, and then it became an appetite, and then it was a hunger. And I remember very reluctantly going to church at the suggestion of a friend. And, I mean, I went into it as a sort of sceptical, critical spectator and came out a participant. And I had a moment of conversion in there which was decisive and powerful. In retrospect, of course, it had been coming on forever. But at the moment, it really did feel like this utterly decisive and fundamental, profound change. And I've not looked back, as it were.
Right. It's obviously led you eventually to the path to ordination and the ministry you have now, as well as obviously your career in the media and all that goes with it. But did you sort of at some level find something that you had been looking for during your sort of days as a pop star and the life?
Well, I think we were very preachy sort of pop star. And if you look at a video of me in the 1980s, it's obviously a vicar struggling to get out. So I don't think it really... I remember when I announced it to people, you'll never guess what I'm doing now. They went, oh, yeah, right. Maybe not such a surprise. And I ran into my former school chaplain, who I'd given hell to when I was at school, and said, well, you won't believe this, but... And he said, well, of course you are. So I think... And I think that there in me there was a sort of looking for something. And a response to a certain kind of song, if you like, of liberation and inquiry, that when I kind of tuned into that particular frequency and tuned into that particular temperament, I kind of recognised it. It was not quite déjà vu. It was more than déjà vu. It was a sense that here was something that had been there all the time and my circuits weren't firing, and then all of a sudden they were.
It's great to have you tell that story. And in a way, the search for meaning is obviously the topic that we're going to be talking about during the rest of today's programme.
Meaning's like catnip to me.
I love a drop of meaning.
Well, I think you do too, Darren, don't you? Yeah. Love a bit of meaning.
Yeah.
I mean, the book you've written is called Happy, Darren. Is there a difference, though, between happiness and sort of meaning, would you say, or are they
yes,
one and the same?
I think so, and I think meaning trumps happiness, ultimately. The book I wrote, I was very interested in the Stoics, and still am, and spent about 3 years writing that book on when I was on tour, mainly, and doing the shows in the evening. It was a lovely sort of rhythm to that. And I think, and Stoicism was the predominant school of philosophy for 500 years before Christianity sort of took over, really, to the extent that it sort of had to win over the Stoics. A lot of Stoic ideas, like being a dutiful citizen and so on, can be traced up through Christianity now. So I think it still sort of sits perfectly well with it. Obviously, it's a secular school of thought, but it's not, I think, by no means a sort of a clash. And at the end of writing the book, I sort of also realised what it was missing. I realised there was a big sort of gap, and I'm sort of, you know, beginning to get my head around what a next book would be to sort of continue that that thought into another area. And I think the gap, I think the bit that's missing is where religion sits very well. I think it's a very nice complement to it. So Stoicism is very much about sort of a personal robustness.
Yes.
And it's great. I mean, it's a phenomenal recipe for avoiding anxiety and avoiding those feelings of disturbance, which is how they saw happiness back in there. So sort of a tranquility. It's about only controlling what you're in control of, which are your thoughts and your actions, and deciding that everything else, what other people do, what they think, and so on, is fine. It's absolutely fine as it is. Not only is it fine, but it's absolutely the best way things should be. So you move in a much easier accordance with fate, as they used to call it, as opposed to nowadays we're told, you know, set your goals and believe in yourself and you make everything exactly how you'd like it to be, which of course creates a lot of anxiety. And that was the reason for writing the book. And I think that's a hugely valuable thing.
Something we need to rediscover today.
I think it is. What it misses is things like, well, it's quite a self-centered thing, and it isn't really, because when you look at the Stoics, they were very interested in, as I said, being a good citizen, and it's, you do all that in order to give out, but they didn't really have a lot to say about things like kindness and community, and also the value of anxiety. I think that's the big thing that's missing. I think the value of disturbance, the value of, you know, you only move forward, you only find meaning, your life only gets larger and moves forward if you pay attention to what makes you anxious.
I mean, Stoicism isn't the same thing, though, necessarily, as being sort of emotionless. I think a lot of people think of it as a sort
it's got a bit of a bad, it's got a bit of a bad rap. Like Epicureanism has nothing to do with really what Epicurus was saying either. No, it really is about differentiating. I mean, this is grossly reducing it. But first of all, realizing that things, your problems are not really created by events in the world. They're created by the story you tell yourself about those events. That's first of all. I mean, it's sort of a bit glib to us because we've heard it, but actually it's a really, big thought. And the other big thought is there are those things you're in control of and the things you're not. And so there's a certain amount of detachment, I guess, from things like wealth and all those kind of, you know, the things like that sort of a Buddhist would say you would detach yourself from, but they're not seen as bad. They're sort of seen as sort of indifferent, and they're not bad things to have, but certainly not at the expense of this kind of robust virtue.
And even death, ultimately, there's a sort of a Stoic attitude towards death as sort of not seeing it as something to be feared, but as just, well, you won't be here anymore, and that's okay.
Yeah,
too,
well, it was certainly a time when a lot of those things were being discussed, and there were lots of sort of slightly unconvincing arguments as to why we shouldn't fear death, like you're not going to be there when it happens. Well, okay, that's true. Or the idea that, well, you've already been there. You've already been in the sort of abyss of nothingness before you were born, and that was fine, so it'll be fine again. And they're kind of interesting sort of thought experiments to go through and realise why they don't quite hold up.
Right.
But they don't quite solve the... I think the thing that is missing, and one of the reasons why death is frightening, is much more to do with the lack of myth and meaning associated with it now, which again is where something like religion would step in a lot more comfortably.
I kind of love the Stoic virtues and would sort of seek to cultivate them in myself, paltry little things that they are in me, but because I think as a way of influencing your personal conduct, how you behave, how you get through life. much to be admired in that.
Yes.
And also much to, I think, one of the great things about death is that you'll never have to fill in a form again, which is one of the things that contents me. But I think what's different about it, or one of the things that's different about it that strikes me, is that it seeks to realise meaning and value and how we consider ourselves and how we conduct ourselves through reference to our own resources, thought, action. Whereas I think what Christianity does and other religions do is suggest that there's an axis beyond ourselves, a transcendent reality beyond ourselves in which we're implicated, but has a bearing on all those things. And because of that, can make things which seem counterintuitive or contrary to our own benefit or goodness valuable. Suffering, I suppose, would be one.
Yeah.
Stoics accept suffering, I think, and endure suffering. But I think sometimes in Christianity it's given a positive evaluation to it as a means of transformation, as a means of living a new life, which exists because of the death of God on the cross. And that's all of a sudden something that's available to us to live in anticipation of that in this life. And I think that changes. That's one of the differences between Athens and Jerusalem.
Yes. Well, I certainly agree. And was it Aeschylus, probably the first great tragedian, said that it's only from suffering comes wisdom, or words to that effect. Which, again, I think the Stoics, I think they sort of lack that thought. And I think as we become psychologically sort of more aware, as we certainly have, recent years generally, I think with that dialogue, the dialogue with the self becomes, that being aware of your own growth and moving forward, and whether things in life make you smaller or larger, for example, whether this is the stuff of meaning, and I think it's tremendously important. I think the role of suffering, the fact that we used to say that if people were sort of at the bottom end of things, they were unfortunate. Nowadays, they can be called losers, and the big difference is the idea of fortune, that there is something, life events that throw back at us. And over again, it was one of the things I was sort of found as I was researching for the book that I wrote, is this idea of an X equals Y line. So one axis, you have your aims, your desires.
Mm.
At the other axis is stuff that life throws back at you. And actually what life is, and living well and flourishing, seems to be about navigating an X equals Y diagonal. Freud, when he created psychotherapy, wasn't doing it to make people happy, was doing it to restore what he called a natural unhappiness, that life is basically sort of unhappy, but you don't want to be unnaturally unhappy,
yes.
But there is a natural unhappiness. Schopenhauer talks about, when you start off a game of chess, you might have a plan, but you can't stick to that plan throughout the whole game. That doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
Joseph Conrad talks about you can spend your life climbing a ladder and get to the top and realize you had it against the wrong wall.
I love that.
Some of the work on happiness, as a sociologist called Michael Csikszentmihalyi did this project on flow, as he called it. Time and time again, when people are in their best state, they report, whether it's chess or surfing or anything, they report a sort of a balance between what you're trying to achieve, the skills you have, and the challenges that you face. And when those things match up, so if your challenges are too much, you become anxious. If the skills are too much, you become bored. Again and again, this sort of feeling resonates that actually there's something in that X equals Y line. But to do that, we have to recapture and, I suppose, respect again the idea of fortune. But we don't read tragedy, so we've lost that. But we believe instead that you can just crank everything up to your own desires.
We had to do a thing recently, it was a diocesan thing, where we had to do a sort of strap line for our church.
Mm.
So at first I said, preaching the gospel and celebrating the sacraments. They went, we know you did that, we need something that's kind of... So in the end I came up with the church welcoming losers since naught. But they wouldn't have that. But I do think that there is something...
That would be genius. You should have made them take it.
Well, they didn't like the word losers, unfortunately, which is bad, because you think if anyone should be kind of okay with the notion of losers, it should be the church, really. I think that's a very fundamental... And also, one of the points where we have a real purchase in a world which so hugely values success, prestige, all that kind of thing, wealth, stuff that comes with that, self-realization, is kind of at the centre of the Christian gospel is this notion that you have to efface that, step away from that, says the vicar on Strictly, in order for something else to begin to be born, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a very counterintuitive gospel.
Well, it's time for a short break. I'm Justin Brierley, bringing you the third episode of our big conversation series here on Unbelievable, as illusionist Derren Brown and Christian priest and broadcaster Reverend Richard Coles discuss the search for happiness and whether we can have meaning without God. And, of course, you can watch the Technicolor video of this discussion at thebigconversation.show. But we've kept back an exclusive and, frankly, hilarious clip from the video version of Derren and Richard discussing the funny side of death. Do you want to see it? Well, you'll get access if you sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter. It's just one of the many perks of joining the mailing list. So sign up at thebigconversation.show and we'll be back with part two shortly.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue.
He's the pastor famous for marrying Kanye West and Kim Kardashian. We talked to the megachurch preacher Rich Wilkerson Jr. Jesus told us to love our neighbours, but do we even know who they are? Read our shocking report. Plus, discover how Catholics are questioning the Pope's views on doctrine, and why are so many young men following Jordan B. Peterson?
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, our third episode today of The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable. This isn't just a radio show and podcast, it's also a high-quality video series at thebigconversation.show. Now back for the second part of today's discussion between Derren Brown and Reverend Richard Coles, discussing the search for happiness and whether we can have meaning without God. What about the question that we began with, which is, can we have meaning without God? I mean, I'm guessing you're not going to say, no, you absolutely can't have any kind of meaning without God,
I think,
Richard.
Of course you can have people. I'm always sort of struck by how many people I know. I mean, most of my friends are not believers, in fact. They would describe themselves as aphilatelists, I think, or quasi-philatelists or something. But they're not committed. They're not people of faith. And I don't see anything in them which suggests to me that they live lives of impoverished personal morality. On the contrary, I think lots of them live their lives very much with a view to living decently. I think there's a certain kind of life that you live that's consonant with Christian tradition and teaching and doctrine that's different and distinctive. And as in my own life, I think it introduces a richness to it too, which wasn't there before. But the other interesting thing is, of course, most of my friends grew up as I grew up in Britain in the late 20th century. And whether we like it or not, that's a place, a time, and a culture that is hugely influenced by Christianity, because Christendom prevailed for so long. Our institutions were shaped by it, and by extension, what we think, what we say, what we do, what's important to us is hugely shaped by the distinctiveness of Christianity. And it takes a long time, I think, before you can consider yourself no longer shaped or influenced by that. A friend of mine, he's a really good guy, and I remember saying to him, I was having an argument in the days when I used to argue such things, and he said, look, I can live a decent moral life without any recourse to Christian tradition at all. I said, okay, sum up your beliefs then in exactly that way without having anything to Christian. He said, exactly, do unto others as you would have them do to you. Okay, it's been said before.
Except, it's been said, but if you were to look through any biblical content on with any sort of moral message, some of which clearly is going to be abhorrent to us nowadays, the bits that you discard because they're sort of their time or whatever, and then you which is, I think, perfectly valid to not pay attention to those bits and pay attention to these bits because they're more useful now, but the criteria that you use to separate those two has to be something outside the religious teaching, because that's the very thing that you know, there has to be, so that, which does suggest that ultimately our kind of moral sense lies outside of that. Otherwise, how would you be able to look through the Bible and go, well, that's not relevant, and that is. Does that
make
sense?
Well, I wouldn't make a distinction of relevance, really. I mean, I wouldn't edit the Bible in terms of its kind of immediate utility to me and how that accords with my sense of myself in the world now. Mm. Marcion did that in the second century, one of our most prominent early heretics, in fact. Because I think we need to have... I think that the religious tradition needs to preserve something distinctive and enduring against which you measure precisely your own objective experience. the extent to which you do that and how far you find that challenges your sense of where authority might lie is an interesting question. But it's not, I mean, I wouldn't edit the Bible to suit the sensibility of someone who was born in the late 20th century in somewhere like Britain, because it needs to be something that's bigger than that, I think. It needs to be a narrative which involves more than that.
Yeah.
And a narrative which holds you to account in ways that can sometimes be extremely uncomfortable. The most persuasive thing about Christianity for me is not the niceness, it's the nastiness, it's the toughness, it's the taking you to places you don't want to go. It's the echo it sends back which makes you feel bad. It's the realization of the very, very narrow limits of your own competence and fitness and ability, that kind of thing. That's the stuff which for me ultimately becomes persuasive, I think.
Yes, and that's also where the sort of where we have to search for meaning, isn't it? It's on the edges of when we're infants, we scream and the world provides. You know, our mother or caregiver comes and gives us what we want, and part of growing up is realizing that that doesn't happen and can't happen. Part of a mother's job is to sort of, you know, let go and let us be disillusioned. So we grow up, and tolerating then ambiguity and ambivalence and uncertainty and all those things become part of growing up. And I think any sort of mature spirituality or belief or sense of connection with anything transcendent, which I think is vital that we all find in some sense, not in an overtly spiritual sense, but just that connection with transcendence, I think is what we both agree is important.
When you say transcendence, yeah, though, in what sense do you mean it? Because when I think of transcendent, I think of something that transcends, you know, the physicality of our world, the sort of, if all that really ultimately exists, let's say, is matter in motion and physical forces. When we have a transcendent experience, it's almost something that takes us beyond that and says there's something more than this. And I think we're all looking for the transcendent. That seems to be a universal search across human culture. For you, though, Darren, presumably you don't feel that needs to find its end in God or something beyond the physical world that we do find ourselves in, whereas I presume for Richard it does.
I'm sure we'd probably connect greatly on it, because I think the problem is maybe the word God. The problem is any noun. I think what happens is we actually live in a world of messy active verbs. Things are happening, and they are complex and they are ambivalent, and but to navigate all of that, this sort of infinite data source, we have to reduce and tell ourselves stories and make up clear narratives. It's the only way we can move forward. And when you do that, you take, like, happiness, for example. So, you know, happiness is suddenly a word and it's a noun, and actually the reality is it isn't. It's much more about searching for meaning, it's much more about this and that, all of which are verbs. So I think the problem is maybe that words like the soul and words like God and so on can get, on the one hand, sentimentalized by the kind of New Age thinking, but also become dogmatized and too rigid by some religious thinking. I suppose my feeling towards it is that at some point in history, these ideas, whether connected around a person or whatever made a society into a community, whatever bonded them together, had a certain sort of energy to that, for want of a better word. There was a feeling and a knowledge and a thing that did give you that feeling of transcendence. Yeah. And then as time goes on, it sort of moves out of living memory. So the group tries to maintain that by certain practices and certain things that will recreate that feeling of transcendence, and then gradually that turns into an experience of sort of a belief, which is quite different from what it originally was. Belief and images and sort of dogma and signs and things that are pointing back, but they're not the thing itself. And then that is part of then what becomes sort of institutionalized and what becomes defended and sort of becomes the modern image of that religion. But it's and you could even argue as a sort of idolatry, because it's the images that become paramount. But actually, it's the thing back there that was most important. And sorry, just to finish, but the I think a lot of the problem with a lot of modern atheism is that it's very easy to knock down those things at this end. to knock down some of those sort of claims. Whereas actually what it's missing is, well, if you go back to what it's trying to articulate, that is something that's valid. But the problem is, even the, say the word God, when Nietzsche said God is dead, that was, he was sort of making that point that it's the, by giving it that name, it's sort of the stuff of it, the energy of it, has sort of been too contained.
It's a summary of church history, in fact, which has been in lots of ways kind of conforms to that, I think, this extraordinary transforming experience that the people around Jesus of Nazareth had. But of course, we don't know about that. I mean, the first writings in the New Testament, as you know, are Paul, and that's coming along quite some time after the events they describe. The first gospel, the earliest, is probably around 75, a generation after the events they describe, because I think the first followers of Jesus thought, and should be consistent with the messianic teaching of that period, that the end of time was going to come within their lifetime.
Yeah.
They would see it. And then, of course, they start dying out, hang on a minute, so we better write this down. And by the time they're writing it down, it's not reportage.
Yeah.
It's not an account of what happened. It's a theological treatise. They're already bringing to bear deep reflection on what those events might mean in a context that's suddenly changing, becoming larger. And then you get Paul comes along, and there are all sorts of, again, hugely reductive way of describing it, gross generalization too, but Paul, I think, represents the bringing together of the power of Greek thought and the power of Jewish monotheism. And those two things come together, and that's like an explosion. And you still get that now, reading Paul, now this kind of extraordinary explosive force.
Why has that remained, in a sense, such a potent thing, though, 2,000 years later?
Well, two reasons, I think. One, because the tradition has been curated so carefully, preserved so carefully, but partly also because I think people continue to encounter something in that that is absolutely vital and dynamic. And now, that experience of encountering the reality of a risen Christ, as Paul had on the road to Damascus, is something which still continues to happen to people and is persuasive in a way that, I mean, I would never have been persuaded by a sermon or by Christian doctrine as if I was ever going to read it, even by the Narnia books. But that experience of an encounter with the reality of the resurrected Christ is life-changing, and I still continue to live in the kind of, not quite the afterburn of that, but the changed reality that you experience in that. And I think that's something you encounter in lots of religious traditions.
Do you think is going on, though, from your perspective, Darren, with Richard's encounter that he says he had? Because presumably you don't believe there was an encounter with a risen Christ, that presumably there's something psychological or something that can be reduced ultimately.
I don't think it matters. I don't think that matters. I think it matters hugely. I think what matters is that it happened. I think, you know, various people might go, oh, I think it was predominantly this experience or this or that, or it had its roots in this psychological thing or whatever. I don't think that's interesting. I think what's interesting is the richness and the truth, if you like, of something that makes us connect with that thing that is outside of ourselves. And I can't put a name on that or call it God. I don't think it is a thing. I think the trouble is finding the very words for it. But it's an experience, a sort of and I sort of turn it back in on itself. I think it's to do for me with a kind of how you live in a way that is coming to the edge of all the things you sort of comfortably accept. And I think that would also include a lot of religious teaching as well, coming to the edge of those things, and in that kind of where yin meets yang kind of is where the sort of dialogue with yourself and where the sort of individual meets the sort of the infinite is where meaning happens. I resist the idea of, you know, sort of giving it a name. I think it is a psychological experience, but I think it's the most important and valuable one that we have.
You sound fascinatingly, though, not very like an atheist at this point, because you're talking about something that is beyond yourself, that is, in a sense, the most important thing that there is.
Well, beyond myself, but also entirely myself and ultimately myself.
Because you're not sensing that with means beyond your cognition, are you? Or your unconscious. It's not. I mean, I completely agree with you on that. My experience of the encounter with the resurrected Christ is like my experience with KFC. It's just something that's there. Mm. I mean, and I perceive that with the senses that are made available in order to do that. Mm. But it's the richness of that experience and the power of it, I think.
Can I talk about death? Because Please. That is the place you end the book, talking about the fact that, you know, across time, in a sense, death has always been, as it is put by St. Paul, the last enemy, and so on. And in a sense, the Christian story is obviously about God becoming incarnate and experiencing death, but overcoming death ultimately in the resurrection. Is that for you an important thing in terms of where we get our meaning? A lot of people would say that it's important to know that death is not the end, that somehow our life has a purpose that goes beyond our short span of years.
Yeah, I mean, lots of religions would argue the same thing, that this is not all there is, and there is something beyond our physical death. Christianity, of course, does it in a very particular way. And I think one of the reasons why it was so explosive for those who were witnesses to the events of Easter is because it was a total abject failure. That what happened was an absolute catastrophe. Everything went hideously wrong, and the person upon whom all that, you know, had laid their expectation, however we understand that to be, ended up getting crucified and dying, and it was spectacularly game over. And everyone kind of scatters and runs off into the unknowability of history, and then all of a sudden, a dead man is alive again. That's the kind of irreducible, I would say, fact at the heart of Christianity. Unlikely, but then of course it would be, wouldn't it? And I think one of the, in a post-Enlightenment world, when our scientific, our sort of way in which we consider to be reliable authoritative evidence is about a method which deduces patterns and from that begins to make judgments about what's reliable, what happens, we're talking about a singularity. And if Christianity is right, and that God did become human, well, he had to become a human in a place, in a time. So this unlikely, completely insignificant, dusty corner of the Roman Empire, it could have been everywhere, but it wasn't. It was there. And so the unlikelihood is absolutely built into that. So the fact that it is extremely unlikely, the fact that it does not accord with the kind of instruments that we'd bring to making judgments about the veracity of something now, is for me actually again part of its persuasiveness rather than its unpersuasiveness.
I mean, you obviously weren't persuaded when you looked into the resurrection, and I don't know whether in all honesty, what you've described, Richard, is in any sense, you know, you're looking at the historical facts and making a deduction from it. I think obviously you've had an experience which you see in the light of that experience that people claimed back then as well, but for you, is the resurrection in that sense a sort of an important thing in which we find that meaning that allows us to hope, to have purpose, to have, I suppose, for many people who don't have any kind of opportunity as the three of us have to lead meaningful lives in, you know, a westernized country with all the opportunities that affords, the idea of a day of judgment and justice in a world to come is the only hope they may have of meaning eventually.
Well, I mean, also just say that it is for me. Lots of people seem to manage their lives, live their lives quite successfully and happily without having that. But it is for me in a way which is kind of unlike anything else, I think. And lots of people, I mean, I'm not alone, lots of people would share that experience. And one of the kind of odd things about that is when you kind of read people, come across people who've had that experience in different, either in different moments in history or in different places, there's often a sort of consonance about that that's kind of interesting, I think.
What do you make of people who do find their meaning in that particular way of seeing, and the resurrection in particular?
I sort of don't really consider it my business, but I suppose in as much as we're talking about it, I think it's I think the only thing that's any sort of value judgment anywhere in the mix is that there'd be a difference between sort of taking on board a religious belief because it's sort of comfortable And as I've heard from friends of mine, say, well, I don't have to think about that. That's kind of a nice, you don't have to think. You spend the rest of your life sweating and thinking over other things. And that, like, it's just nice and comfy, which, of course, is fine too. Again, none of my business if that is what someone wants to do. And a sort of religious belief in which a person can grow, again, spiritually in a, you know, wider sense of the word, and confront those, you know, the edges and the doubts and the things that make us bigger and grow larger. There's Rilke has a poem about I can't remember the poem exactly, but he talks about, no, it wasn't even a poem, no, it was in one of his letters, the idea of living in a large room or a small room. Some people live in a large room, some people live in a small room, some people just pace up and down by the window. So I sometimes think it's sort of me, I'm probably in that bit, but it's hard for me because I'm quite introverted and I'm a little bit shy, and I have to really summon up something to do things that I know will actually make life larger rather than just comfortable and smaller and avoid stress, which is why I'm a good stoic. Why that sits very comfortably with me. I think that's the thing that's important, and I think and if it's just the sort of a religious belief that's sort of one of comfort, which again is fine and none of my business, but then it's not much different from any number of other sort of comfortable things which ultimately don't really feed the soul, to use the word soul. And that's sort of the difference to me. I don't think it really matters too much where you find it. It's just the quality of it. Is it giving you a sort of energized connection to some sort of other? And I'm using words like that, which sounds like I'm talking about God. I'm talking about a purely psychological relationship with yourself and with the idea of the transcendent. I remember when I was a Christian listening to atheists that remotely used that kind of language and going, oh, well, he's obviously, you know, you can tell there's a God-shaped hole and you can tell he believes in all that. I'm trying to articulate a kind of a psychological relationship to meaning.
But ultimately, if you find your meaning in a religious expression or in the resurrection, whatever it might be, that is great if it works for you at giving you that sense of meaning. But other people can find just the same meaning, in a sense, in the activities they pursue, or the family life, or whatever it might be that gives them that sense of comfort.
You sort of want to find the thing that's bigger than you, and you know, and find the thing you love, and you throw yourself into that thing. That's sort of ultimately how we find meaning. And then from that, in terms of how it makes you grow, then I think it depends on your relationship with that.
I mean, what's kind of different about Christianity for me is that it's not comforting or consoling.
Yes.
Can be, but actually much more than that is its challenge, I think, and it's what it returns to you is so not what you think you're going to get. I guess this is something that happens in prayer an awful lot. I spent 2 years in a monastery kind of praying in a very organized sort of way. I'm fascinated by that, and what often struck me about that was the returns of it are just not what I thought they would be. And not in any, and I sometimes think people think that spirituality, again, gross generalization, I don't mean you, by the way, think of it as a sort of accomplishment, things you master in order to achieve a kind of greater serenity or something like that. And I don't think that's what Christianity is at all, actually.
It should be uncomfortable, shouldn't it? All these things should be ultimately uncomfortable and challenging.
I remember once being in church on Good Friday, and there was a particularly gory crucifix standing on the altar, and a choir singing Allegri Miserere, heart-wrenching stuff about the absolute desolation of a God abandoned to death on a cross. And I remember at the end of it saying to my neighbour and saying, that was amazing, wasn't it? She said, yeah, it's very relaxing. And I thought, that's interesting, isn't it? What have we done as a church? I mean, I think another thing the Stoic virtues appeal to me very much is they do seem to give you a very good defence against lapsing into complacency about the awfulness of institutions. And the church is perhaps the most awful of institutions because the stakes are so high and it's been doing it for so long. I remember a bishop, I won't say which one, when I was particularly irked by something in the church, said, you must remember all institutions are demonic, which I think is probably true. And to cultivate a bit of stoic detachment and a critical angle to that. I'm very interested in what you were saying also about aspects of the smoke and mirrors stuff. I spent a lot of time in Lincoln Cathedral, which, as you know, in the Middle Ages was a great place of pilgrimage, still is now. It's a spectacularly beautiful building. I remember walking around it, and there's this thing called the pulpitum, which is this incredibly beautiful carved 14th century screen through which pilgrims would go on the way to the shrine of St. Hugh, kind of Journey's End. And you go through it, and it's this wonderful evocation in stone, the absolute summit of the art of carving, of entering into a place of holiness and judgment. And then you look behind you, and it's just a blank wall. And it's so showbiz. Mm. It's so... And I'm very struck how religion, once it systematizes and organizes and seeks to mobilize people, begins to behave in that sort of way, because that's what institutions do. And in order to do, especially if your offer is supernatural, then it's good if you've got some smoke and mirrors to go with that.
Yeah, I ended up at a very happy clappy church in Croydon for a while, at the sort of peak of my... religious experience.
The sort of happiness in Croydon seems so
counterintuitive.
Sorry, Croydon.
Sorry, Croydon.
It's unfair. It has blossomed into non-entity since I was last there. And there was, I remember we were all told to stand up and talk in tongues, which obviously only a small percentage of the congregation would have been used to talking in tongues. So he said, just start making, and this is the pastor, just start making a noise and a sound. And if you think, oh, this is just silly, I'm just making a sound, that's the devil telling you that. And I sort of stood there. Well, of course, there's general babbles going on, thinking, well, this can't just be me that thinks this is just creating a sort of sensation. You know, has this all become reduced to a kind of a show, a sort of, you know, a sort of an experience that may not even be that convincing for the individuals, but somehow when you put it all together, you sort of tell yourself the story that something amazing has happened. So yes, it's a bit of a shame, isn't it, a bit of a worldly thing that I don't know how you totally avoid that either, because you need to appeal to the emotions too, which religion's always been so good at.
And then, I mean, even one of the kind of interesting things about getting ordained is that you are ordained to serve this life-changing mystery that you've encountered, and you end up handing out hymn books and using green china a lot, that kind of thing. Again, it's in the nature of institutionalizing and systematizing something elusive and yet unforgettable.
It's time for our final break. You're listening to the third episode of our Big Conversation series here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, as illusionist Derren Brown and Christian priest and broadcaster Reverend Richard Coles discuss the search for happiness and whether we can have meaning without God. You can watch all of our Big Conversations in glorious video at thebigconversation.show. But we've kept back an exclusive and actually really funny clip of Derren and Richard discussing the funny side of death, just for subscribers. If you want to see it, you'll get access to it if you sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter. So do that at the website, thebigconversation.show, and I'll be back with part three very shortly.
Welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, our third episode today of The Big Conversation with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you engaging interactions between believers and non-believers. Check out the full schedule of episodes in this special series at thebigconversation.show. We're also uploading related blogs there. The latest one is Andy Walton explaining why the last episode between Steven Pinker and Nick Spencer shows why atheist-Christian debates still matter. And I'll read a little bit from that later on. If you've been enjoying the series so far, final places are now going fast for our live audience edition of The Big Conversation, taking place on Wednesday, the 18th of July in London. We're going to be joined by Professors John Lennox and Michael Roos, a Christian and an atheist, to discuss science, faith, and the evidence for God. You can be there too. There will be audience Q&A, chance to interact with my guests. Just click on the live debate link at thebigconversation.show. And if you can't be there, don't worry. It will be recorded and broadcast in September as part of this Big Conversation series. And speaking of live Unbelievable events, have you heard
Unbelievable is coming to the USA. Yes, our very first Unbelievable Conference USA takes place at Westside, a Jesus Church in Portland, Oregon, on Friday the 31st of August and Saturday the 1st of September. I will be sharing more information on that at the end of today's programme. But for now, let's get into the final part of the big conversation between atheist illusionist Derren Brown and pop star turned priest Reverend Richard Coles.
I wonder this, do you, once you become a vicar and you're asked these sorts of questions, do you feel like a politician being asked questions? Do you feel like there's a sort of party line that you have to sort of toe, and that actually expressing, well, presumably all the really interesting stuff, doubts, and that is sort of not, no longer really appropriate?
Well, in the days when I was dutiful and diligent, I think I would say, well, the church says, and then say, as best as I could, an account of that. And I'd still do that if people want to ask, but people don't ask that sort of question normally. They ask something, what have I to say about the agony that they're experiencing, or the joy that is kind of out of reach, or perhaps overwhelming. And so I try to talk to that. I try to avoid talking too propositionally about it. Also, I'm not very good at it. I'm a pretty ropey theologian. And also, I find that people relate more readily. It's an interesting one, I think. And again, it's because of where we are in our post-enlightenment cycle, putting it crudely, broad brushstrokes. People relate, they don't relate to doctrine, they don't relate to sermons, they sing hymns without connecting the strangeness of the language or the distinctiveness of the language. They relate to people who make a commitment to it. That seems, I mean, that just seems, people are very curious about that and interested about that. And they relate to personal stories.
Yeah.
Again, it's a sort of symptomatic of our time, I think. And so I try to, if people ask me stuff, then I try to respond in that kind.
Be present with them as a human being.
Also, I think try to, through your actions, live a life which is consonant with the gospel you preach. I mean, St. Francis said, always preach, sometimes use words. And for someone like me who's garrulous and self-absorbed, shutting up can be a surprisingly powerful thing. Rare.
I mean, it's probably worth saying that meaning, I'm sure, is often bound up with purpose and with hope and those sorts of things. And I would imagine that in your sort of worldview, Richard, those are provided in a sense in some ultimate way by Jesus Christ and the resurrection and the things that Christianity says life is ultimately about. In an more atheistic sort of worldview, would you say hope and purpose is found? I think it was Nietzsche who said something like, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. There's that sense that purpose is a prerequisite to being able to have a fulfilling life. Obviously, as I say, Richard's perspective sort of grants that at some ultimate level. Does an atheistic perspective have that? Is it just a case of finding purpose with, let's say, a small p rather than a capital transcendent p?
Well, I think first of all, you have to realise, if it's not being given to you on a plate, I suppose, that meaning is important, that is actually an important part of life, because that isn't necessarily obvious. It isn't obvious in the culture that we live in. As Heidegger said, the old gods have vanished and the new ones are yet to arrive, and we're in this sort of mythologically quite sort of empty point at the moment. So yeah, you have to find that for yourself, and that's a different situation than having a belief in a life in something that is ultimately providing that sort of framework. And of course it is hugely important, and where I differ probably from a lot of the sort of what gets called sort of the new atheists is that as important as truth is, and as important as holding up claims, you know, to some kind of rigor is, I think that meaning actually is sort of more important, which is sort of a psychological truth, a subjective truth is probably more important. It's the people that don't have meaning that throw themselves off buildings. So yes, you have to find that. You do have to find it on your own. But I think some people will find that in their children. Others will find it in their projects. Others will find it, like me, more through sort of reading and through and through growing up and being aware of those sorts of issues. We're both in our 40s,
50s. Thank you for that.
And you know what? Those issues that age are different than when you're in your 20s. You know, the best you can do is be aware of yourself as a growing creature, and then explore,
What about the person for whom there is really no purpose, who lives perhaps a, you know, a miserable life. I don't know the, I don't know what you made, for instance, of the atheist bus campaign slogan. There's probably no God now. Stop worrying and enjoy your life. Well, that may not be possible for the war widow in Darfur who is facing, you know, at the very bottom of life's heap. Let's say it can sound rather trite, in fact, at that point. And it may be that for that person, it is only the only consolation they have is that there will one day be a day of justice, where as it were, the world is put to rights, and there's a sort of a sense in which they will see ultimate meaning and ultimate purpose, because they were never had the opportunity that we had to experience.
I mean, I guess you could argue that there are other forms of finding meaning, and but you'd have to work with them to find them. So that argument, the one that's handed to you isn't necessarily doing its job as well as the one that you suffer to find, you know. And suffering obviously is entirely tied up with the Christian story, which is one of the reasons why I think it is so resonant and has value outside of that.
There's and so problematic too, I think.
Problematic, the idea of suffering.
Yeah, the idea to give a positive value to suffering, of course, is extremely problematic. And I think lots of people have kind of heaped upon themselves suffering unnecessarily. And the idea that was a kind of... The other thing on meaning, you said something very interesting about an absence of meaning is what makes people throw themselves off buildings. Sometimes I would think a surfeit of meaning is what makes people throw other people off buildings. And I would... That's a caveat that I'm sort of constantly trying to kind of keep in front of me, is it would be misleading at the very least to suggest that somehow religious affiliation and the meaning that comes with that necessarily produces something benign, because it doesn't. And one of the reasons for that is, I think, precisely because of death. I think if you're signed up to a system in which there is an offer of something beyond your own existence, that can sometimes make your own existence something easy to parlay into something else. So I'm really conscious, I don't want to seem like a kind of someone who's not aware that there are lots of ways in which belief goes bad.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, you often talk about in your books and in your stage shows as well, Darren, the idea that we're all storytelling creatures, is the way you put it. We have to live within some sort of a narrative, a story, to make sense of life, in a sense. That's the way we get through life. Yeah. In that sense, is what Richard is describing, what Christians claim and other religions, just doing that, just sort of telling a story, obviously doesn't necessarily make it true, but it works in a sense.
Yeah, Schopenhauer had this idea that actually all religion is a sort of folk mythology that everybody has to buy into and pretend that it's true. No one can say it isn't. No one can say it's just mythology, and the whole thing falls apart. Everyone has to play the game, Vickers included, of pretending that it is true in order for it to work.
In a sense, do you feel though that we're coming into an age where that is no longer the case, where as more and more people obviously tick the non-religious box or whatever it might be, that they're struggling to find a story to live in that maybe previous generations did?
Yes, there was a time when we woke up every morning and our meanings and our role in things were defined for us by the village or the tribe or our family or whatever stories were sort of in place, and we don't have that now. And we struggle to, first of all, we may not even know we're supposed to struggle to find that. Since Kant, I suppose, we see ourselves as these sort of isolated atoms, these units, that the self is something that isn't what it actually is, which is extended into other people and into situations that we find ourselves in. And that creates a sort of, a hole whereby everything else, advertising and everything that comes at us, sort of tells, no, you are this person and you need this, creates this sort of fabricated fantasy of demand. Messes us up. And how do you begin to step out of that and realize that those things aren't actually what it's all about? If you watch a movie or read a book, that last chapter makes sense of everything that's happened before. This doesn't happen in life. When we get to the end of our life, things just sort of end, and it's absurd and it's meaningless. We don't have it's a good sort of example of where our myths have abandoned us the last few hundred years. So what, there is no narrative around death. We no longer live with it as a companion through life, which again, I think religion is does that much more effectively. So unless you find that for yourself, what happens at the end? It's scary and it's lonely. You probably feel like a cameo in your own death, because the main roles have gone to the doctors or your loved ones or people are making decisions for you. And that one time when you should be able to really take ownership of a story and find closure for it in the way that you might do in a film or a book. Forgive who needs forgiving and just end those things in a way that's meaningful. You're normally being denied. The only narrative we do have that gets imposed normally on the dying person is that of the brave battle. Which isn't helpful to the person who's dying at all and just adds failure to the long.
You've obviously got experience of directly counselling and burying people in your ministry.
Yeah, deathbeds.
Richard.
Yeah, I do deathbeds. There's one of the interesting things about them is how often people do want to have a meaningful moment there, that there's a sort of reckoning there or things that need to be said. And often it's when people go for the cup of tea that somebody dies, because actually they've got to get on with dying.
Yeah.
One of my favourite, most memorable moments in ministry was I went to the deathbed of a parishioner, much loved parishioner, who was a very devout and faithful man. And he was in a nursing home and he was on a morphine drive. He was at the end of his life. And he was sort of not quite there and on oxygen. And I went and I took the Book of Common Prayer because he was a traditionalist in that way. And so I read to him from the Book of Common Prayer some of the Psalms. And I read them, I thought, rather beautifully. And I thought this was a suitable thing to do. And I'd anointed him and prepared him according to the tradition. And he sort of stirred and indicated. And he moved his oxygen mask. And I said, yes. And he went, shut up, you stupid twat. You know, I was the person there who was trying to be a good, diligent priest and kind of, you know, kind of richly imbue with meaning what was happening. The guy was dying, and it's a thing that happens, and you need to get on with that. And, you know, it's not about those kind of moments where we feel it most necessary to kind of stand to attention and inhabit those things most fully. It's actually the quality of the whole life and everything that comes with it.
There's that great scene in Ivan Ilyich, Death of Ivan Ilyich, when he's dying and desperately just wanting some honesty and some sort of connection and sort of just to have some authenticity to what's happening. And the I think it's the judge or somebody comes in. He's a lawyer, this man that's dying, if that's right, or is he a judge himself? It's a while since I read it. Either way, this person comes in with whom he works, and it, I guess to make himself feel comfortable, is asking him lots of questions about work, and Ivan, who's dying, is sort of stepping up to that role, and they're having a sort of officious sort of conversation. And it's just tragic. It's absolutely tragic how he's screaming out for a sort of authentic connection with somebody, and it's constantly just sort of denied him. Do you? I didn't realize that was sort of. I guess it is part of your job, isn't it? Do you find? Have you found your way towards that, or is that not? Do you not see that quite as your job at the in that position? Is it a human? Does it ultimately feel like a human point or a sort of professional?
I think there's something deeply mysterious about it, actually. And I feel very conscious of the... I mean, I have a sort of sacramental function in those situations. I go there and I do stuff, and there are words that were there before I was and words that will be there after I'm gone, and actions and things that you do, and signs and symbols and all that. And that does extraordinary... But it's not like going to the theatre. I think one of the things is we want meaning to present itself to us as a sort of, like the culmination of a box set. Do you know what I mean? That there's a kind of the sense of an ending that will kind of tie up loose ends, and all of a sudden from that you will look back and the pattern that has been hard to see will suddenly emerge. And I don't think it is like that, really. Because actually the meaning is beyond ourselves. I suppose that's what I would argue. I completely take your point, though, about the lack of narrative. I was talking to some people recently in my parish at university, and I said, we were talking about politics. I said, how did you vote in the last election? And they said, Jeremy Corbyn. And I said, why? And they said, well, the obvious reasons why. I said, just out of interest, how did you vote in the election before? And they said, UKIP. And I thought, you went from UKIP to Corbyn in one move. Tells you something about the sort of context, or perhaps the lack of context, that people have in which they make important decisions about who they are and their place in the world. And maybe that's symptomatic of that broader decline of the kind of grand narratives that did give us some sort of sense of where we were and how we were in relation to each other.
Darren has talked about the idea of the living in a story, and in a sense it is the Christian story that has given you that sense of who you are and who God is and what it means to live a fulfilled and meaningful life, Richard. But is it just a story? I suppose, many people, I think, will say, well, That's fine. That's your story. I've got my story.
Yeah, because that's what it, but I don't really have a fulfilled or meaningful life. I'm not interested in a fulfilled or meaningful life. I'm interested in trying to be a faithful disciple of Jesus Christ. And that might not produce something which looks either fulfilled or meaningful, in fact. Mm. That's much more important, I think, is trying to be faithful to this, the fathomless riches, as St. Paul put it.
It's not a self-help philosophy that we're invited to in the Gospels.
No, it's not. It's more self-harm than self-help.
But actually, sorry to interrupt, but I think what's valuable there in terms of psychological development is the idea of serving, I think. One of the things that we probably learn in our 40s, if we're attentive to those sorts of things, is the... and again, it's part of death and resurrection as a sort of mythological idea that thing you have in your 20s and 30s when it's all about you and you want to know who you are and what the real you is and you're setting all these things up. There comes a point in life when you have to realize that the sort of ego has to just step down a bit and serve something.
Mm.
And it's hugely important. And I don't think it's a religious idea. But I think, again, if we sit in terms of myths, i.e. things that are there to psychologically resonate with us and show us where we are in terms of a journey or in terms of what it is to live well and flourish, it's very, very important.
I think you often see it with people loving somebody else beyond wisdom or beyond what's good for them or even despairingly, but nonetheless still loving them because it's important. More important to love them and to be faithful to that than the rewards or the returns that might appear to bring. Again, that's something which is not always attractive to see or even advisable, but it is often surprisingly the case, I think.
Mm.
Just as we start to round up the programme, maybe starting with you, Richard, and then Darren, if you come back on this.
And then will you decide who's right?
Yes, that's right. I will then judge who won this conversation. I mean, can you sum up in some sense, Richard, why for you, in the search for meaning, God is the answer in the sense of when you come to the end of the searching in all the different places, God makes the most sense, if you like, of that final search for meaning?
Because at the edge of sight, all of a sudden, the miracle of the lit bush appeared, and there was a bush on fire that was not consumed. I don't know what that's about, but that was there. It happened, and I'll look at that.
And that's, in a sense, an intensely personal perspective. Something happened for you, and
but that happens within a wider context, sure. A bigger narrative, a set of relationships, a historical framework, all that kind of stuff. But essentially, it's turning aside to the miracle of the lit bush. I'm paraphrasing R.S. Thomas, yeah. Of course.
And what about yourself, Darren? Why for you is, well, and maybe it's not for many people, but for you, the finding meaning in God ultimately in something beyond ourselves in that sense is a dead end as far as you're concerned in terms of the search for meaning and purpose and so on.
I don't think it is a dead end at all. I think it's your relationship to the search that matters. I think one of the things that seems to come out of this for me is that actually the stuff that makes the search and the experience worthwhile are actually quite sort of human things. The actual belief itself, the starting point, if you like, forgive me for saying, it seems to matter less than the actual experience of it and the honesty and the openness and the tolerance of ambiguity and uncertainty.
And difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes people say, I'm really sorry, but I'm not a believer.
Yeah.
I think, why are you apologising? I don't mind. It's fine by me.
And I think part of that thing that you sort of intimated earlier on about whether atheism is sort of just another story, and it isn't. It is, by its nature, it isn't a belief or anything. It's sort of meaningless as a label, but what it can often do is narrow into a sort of rigid form in the same way that religious fundamentalism, say, narrows into a rigid form. And then what happens is there's no dialogue, there's no attendance to mystery. And that's, I think, hugely important and always important.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you see symptoms of malaise when people live without that nourishment, I think.
So you're not a fan of a sort of very reductive form of atheism where, you know, we can boil everything down to the chemicals and neurons going on in, in your brain in that sense?
It just means you don't believe in God. That's all. It means nothing beyond that. As to what people do with it after that, that's up to them and right. wherever they're coming from. And of course, that can be unpleasant and reductive, as can a religious life too.
Yes, indeed. It's been fantastic having you both for this conversation. I've really appreciated just the generosity on display from both of you in engaging with each other, and thank you very much for joining me on this edition of the programme.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank yeah.
you. Well, I hope you enjoyed the third episode of The Big Conversation. Do go and watch it at the website, thebigconversation.show. And while there, sign up to the newsletter. We'll send you an exclusive clip of Darren and Richard discussing the funny side of death that you won't find on the YouTube video. We never pass your email on to other people, and we only send you stuff we think you'll be interested in. The regular Unbelievable newsletter is packed with extra features, resources, exclusive content, and more. So do sign up at thebigconversation.show. Now, if you'd like to email your thoughts about today's show, do get in touch the usual ways. Email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave your comments via facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page, or the Twitter is @unbelievablejb. You can also comment underneath today's edition of the podcast at the show page, where you can also, of course, subscribe to the podcast or send this edition of the show on to other people. That's all at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, the Big Conversation episodes are taking a break over the summer, returning on Saturday the 8th of September. That's when we'll air Professor John Lennox and Michael Roos debating science, faith and the evidence for God. And as I've mentioned, we are recording that one in London on the 18th of July, and you can book in to nab one of the final audience places. I'm also really excited, so excited about this, and I'm going to be talking more about this in future episodes, about the forthcoming Unbelievable Conference in the USA. We're being generously hosted by Westside, a Jesus church. Its pastor, Dominic Doan, is a show listener. He's kindly made it possible for us to put the conference on in the USA at the end of this summer. That's Friday, the 31st of August, and Saturday, the 1st of September. So the Friday night is going to be a live dialogue that I'll be hosting between Christian apologist Sean McDowell and a popular atheist blogger Hemant Mehta, who goes online as the Friendly Atheist on Patheos. That's going to be followed up the following day with an all-day conference on the Saturday, the 1st of September. I'll be speaking there, so will Dominic, Sean McDowell, and a variety of other plenary and workshop sessions with other speakers. We're calling it Unbelievable, the Conference, USA, Creating Conversations That Matter. That's our theme. You can go and book in now. They've opened up the booking on the Westside Church website. Here's the link that you need. westsideajc.org/unbelievable-conference. I'll read that out again. westsideajc.org/unbelievable-conference. Conference. Okay, that's where you can now book in. Now, it's not currently, as I'm recording, up on the front page of their church website, but I'm sure it will be soon. And I'll make sure that there are links to that, of course, from the Unbelievable page as well, from today's edition of the show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But it's been exciting to see the reaction from people knowing that Unbelievable is coming to the USA. Justin Jenkins got in touch on Twitter to say, just heard about Unbelievable coming to the USA and even to the Pacific Northwest. Thank you. So excited. Hope I can attend. And I have to say, I do notice a disproportionate number of people who get in touch with the show and share the show coming from that sort of Portland area. So I don't know if Unbelievable is particularly popular in that sort of area of the USA, but I'm really glad to be coming there at the end of the summer. Again, more details at the Westside Jesus Church website. That's westsideajc.org/unbelievable-conference, or go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. That's also the place to go for more content from Unbelievable, including my book, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, and of course to download the podcast, search the archive, get the app, and all the other stuff. No time today for any extended feedback. You've been sending in a lot of emails and comments, though, to the Big Conversation episodes, and I will be reading some of them out next week. A lot of appreciation as well for last week's podcast special when I put out a debate I had on the Atheist Show Dogma Debate with David Smalley. That's available if you want to go back and listen. We've also been putting up some blog responses to The Big Conversation as well at The Big Conversation website. You can read my article for Premier Christianity magazine there, titled "Is Jordan Peterson the Saviour of Christianity?" It's my own reflections on the Jordan Peterson cultural phenomenon, really. And also Nick Spencer's detailed critique of Steven Pinker's book Enlightenment Now. We've added that there. And also just recently, this blog by Andy Walton. Pinker versus Spencer shows why atheist Christian debates still matter. I'm just going to read a little bit from that blog because I thought this was a great piece by Andy Walton, who's a show friend and listener. So this is in response to the second episode of The Big Conversation when Steven Pinker and Nick Spencer sat down to debate whether science, humanism and reason have replaced faith. And in this part of the blog, Andy says, Spencer's knowledge of the intellectual history of the Western world is clearly superior to Pinker, and it showed when Pinker pointed to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as an achievement of non-religious humanist morality that had not a shred of Christianity in it. Spencer immediately fired back that the UDHR was in fact authored by a Lebanese Christian, Charles Malik, and that it was heavily influenced by Catholic social thought. Spencer went further, though, and challenged Pinker's assertion that faith is a block to scientific progress, outlining how the scientists at the helm of the Enlightenment were theists, often Christians. One of the distinctive factors, Spencer argued, is the Christian doctrine of creation that legitimized and encouraged the study of the natural world as a way of understanding and glorifying God. That was the water everyone swam in, the air they breathed, Pinker retorted. It didn't sound convincing. The reason this show was important is that it avoided the trap that so many of us are prone to falling into in contemporary debate. Spencer didn't feel the need to vilify Pinker. Instead, he gently probed and called out the incorrect assumptions fairly and gently when he saw them. For his part, Pinker was cordial and urbane and reiterated his arguments well. It was a grown-up discussion. Pinker's supporters may well have seen a different victor in the discussion than I did. I'm metaphysically invested in his arguments being wrong. As a Christian, it's important I'm honest with myself about that. As one cynical wag in the YouTube comments stated, wow, the person in the talk whose beliefs aligned with my presuppositions sure walked away with this one. But I don't want my side to win just for the sake of victory, and I don't want the other side to lose. The reason The Big Conversation and its parent programme, Unbelievable, are so important is that we live in fissiparious times. Great word, Andy. With conspiracy theorists and crackpots encroaching on the mainstream in increasing numbers, a calm yet robust discussion of this kind across difference is needed more than ever. This spirit of inquiry, wrestling and seeking truth is, after all, what the Enlightenment was about. And for me, what having faith is all about, too. There you go, just a section of that very interesting blog response to last time's Big Conversation, episode 2, between Steven Pinker and Nick Spencer, available to read, along with others, at thebigconversation.show. And do sign up there. Don't miss any of those sorts of interesting articles by signing up to our newsletter, too. Well, thanks for being with me on this edition of Unbelievable today. Sam Hales is here next on Premier with The Profile today, talking to the man who married Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, LA pastor Rich Wilkerson Jr. And you can listen to The Profile on its own podcast too. For now, all that remains for me is to tell you what's coming up on Unbelievable next week.
You're unbelievable.
I'm going to be sitting down with two former Muslims who are going to be in discussion. One of them is Aaliyah Saleem. She became an atheist and has told her story in a new book by ex-Muslims called Leaving Faith Behind. The other is Abdu Murray, North American director of Ravi Zacharias Ministries. Now, Abdu was a Muslim but became a Christian after years of debating and searching the scriptures. They'll be talking about why they both left Islam and why they've come to very different points of view about faith since then. That should be a really interesting show. Hope you can join me for it on the Unbelievable radio show and podcast, and of course all the other ways you can now engage with the program online via video and so forth. But for the moment, thank you for being with me on today's edition of the program, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.